Be a Wine Boat Insider. I'm Ron Edwards, Master Sommelier, and I invite you to explore the people, brands, and trajectory of Wine Boat Fine Wine and Spirits. This is your backstage pass. Meet us on the inside.
In this episode, I'm joined by the president and CEO of Wine Boat Fine Wine and Spirits, Dean Farrell. We talk about growing up in Virginia, music, and the company. Dean, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Really excited to have you.
Thanks, Ron. Great to be here today.
As we all intersect in the world of Winebow, we rarely have the benefit of knowing the background of the person next to us or the person we're talking to. If you don't mind, I'd like to start our conversation by getting a sense of you. How would you describe the backdrop of your childhood?
You know, Ron, I'm a little unique in the fact that, you know, I'm a lifelong Virginian. I've never lived outside of the state. I was born in Roanoke, Virginia. Spent the first 5 years of my life in Blacksburg, Virginia, where I later returned to go to college. We moved to Lynchburg when I was five, and that's where I really grew up and was there through high school. I played golf in high school. I had interests in mechanical drawing in high school, so I did a lot of that, and then so that's what kind of guided me what I may do in college. But also spent a lot of time playing sports, baseball, football, basketball. You know, had a very typical small town, middle class upbringing, which I think has really kept me simple as I've gotten older. And it's something I really appreciate. You know, having that time period. I graduated from high school in 1986, almost 37 years ago. So it's been quite a while, but had a chance to really, you know, have a nice, quiet upbringing and attachment to a community that exists to today. So it's really something that really brings me back home. I enjoy going back to Lynchburg and visiting to this day.
I also was really into mechanical drawing, almost had a minor in it, but that was part of my engineering school. Did you go to Virginia Tech thinking you wanted to be an engineer?
I did. I started out in engineering at Virginia Tech and quickly realized that I probably wasn't prepared to be an engineer academically. I did not take some classes in high school, physics and calculus, that would have better prepared me to be in the engineering program at Virginia Tech right out of the gate. So, you know, I was kind of quickly, overwhelmed with that. And I ended up transferring into the business school and into accounting by the end of my freshman year, which, you know, in hindsight, you know, turned out to be the right decision for how my career progressed once I graduated. But yeah, it started out in engineering. That's why I went to Virginia Tech and, really had a chance to make a lot of good friends there, you know, enjoy some really bad football at Virginia Tech during that time period. You know, that was not the glory years of Virginia Tech football. It was pretty much the bottom of the barrel. I was there for Frank Beamer's first year as a coach. That was my second year of college. So I got to see the early years of that and then enjoyed, you know, what they did later after I graduated. But once again, you know, grounded, you know, in Virginia with going to school there. And actually, too, you know, I have two sisters and they both went to Virginia Tech as well. So it was a complete Farrell family event. So we were all there.
Well, at least during the college football season, you don't have divided loyalties during the games, because that can get a little ugly.
Yes, it can.
Yes.
I'm dealing with that for my children. So
So your children did not go to Virginia Tech, apparently.
One did and one didn't. One went to Virginia Tech and one's at the University of Virginia. So the perfect sort of battle between loyalties there.
I guess that would be equivalent these days to UNC Duke or a divided family of Michigan State and U of M, where I used to live. One of the things that I think becomes very clear if someone has a conversation with you for very long is how passionate you are about music. What's most prominent on your personal playlist?
You know, I think what's most prominent is really the that Seattle sound that emerged as grunge in the early 90s. But it's not limited to that. I think if someone looked at my iTunes, they would think they're looking at iTunes for a group of 10 people, because that's how diverse, you know, my selections are. I mean, really, you know, right now I've probably been listening more to Johnny Cash and Miles Davis than anything else over these last couple of weeks, in addition to holiday music. But the thing that I kind of go back to the most is those Seattle sounds of Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and people like that from the early 90s, which really was sort of a pivotal time period in my life, because that's, you know, that's my early 20s, and it's really a transformational time period as you're adjusting to the longer term of what you're going to do with your career and in your life. But if you go back over time, you know, you can see my first musical love was Kiss as a child of the 70s, you know, and one of the biggest fights I ever had with my mother was not letting me go see Kiss in concert in 1978 at the height of their glory and stage presence as a 10-year-old, which in hindsight, I can understand why my mom did not let me do that. As a 10-year-old, that was something that was a little hard to deal with at that time. And of course, you know, as you go through, you know, as a child of the 80s in high school, you know, there's quite a difference in influences during that. I mean, Michael Jackson, Thriller was huge when I was a freshman in high school, and then I finished with Def Leppard, Pyromania. So it ran the gamut during that time period, but continued to grow in my interests after high school and through college. And it is something that I think I take a lot of pleasure in. You know, one thing that I discovered during COVID, or rediscovered during COVID, was vinyl records. Of course, that's what I grew up on, and had a chance to, you know, kind of rediscover that, you know, during the COVID years, and started to collect vinyl records and listen to vinyl records and really get, you know, reacquainted to the album artwork and the album, you know, information that can provide to enhance your listening experience too.
Yes, that was one of the things I've picked up on since we've been talking about this interview and other things, the diversity of music you enjoy. Is it mood-based? Is it occasion-based? What puts you in the Miles Davis mood versus the Pearl Jam mood?
Yeah, no, I would say it's more mood-based or energy-based. You know, I'm looking for something to get something out of the music that is different, right? Sometimes, you know, if I'm looking to kind of wind down and rest or be thoughtful, you know, Miles Davis or jazz will be something I gravitate towards. Of course, you know, we did have the Delvon Lamar Organ Trio at our event in Seattle last August, which is jazz trio-based groups. So that does roll over to the contemporary listings as well with a group like the DLO3. So it is more mood-based, I would say, than anything else, or just, you know, time of day-based sometimes.
Yeah, that makes sense. Man, and by the way, the trio, they were great. Such a great act. Okay, so vinyl versus digital recording. Can you put your finger on, or have you found a way to describe the difference to you that makes the vinyl more attractive than listening to your playlist digitally?
You know, I think for me, what makes it more attractive is it's interactive. It requires effort to listen to a vinyl record. You just don't say, Alexa, play this, or Siri, play this. You know, it requires you to get up, put the album on, 20 minutes later, flip the album over, listen to the other side. You know, so I think you're more engaged with the music than just having it as background music sometimes. So now, not saying I don't listen a lot to digital, you know, as well, because it's easier, but I do find if I truly want to have a music experience, I think the vinyl gives you that because it makes you engage in the process, is how I would describe listening to vinyl records.
I think it's also interesting that the side benefit, perhaps, to a generation coming back to vinyl that our generation just did, was instead of listening to a mix of single songs from an artist, you actually listen to an entire recording and get the sense of the artist at a different level. Because my kids, they don't really listen to an entire recording album. I like that about vinyl, even if the quality of sound isn't part of the conversation. I just always enjoy hearing the whole picture that the artist had in mind for you when they made the recording.
No, you're exactly right. An album was an intentional selection of songs, right? And they tended to tell a story of what the artist was experiencing or trying to get across during that time period. And you listen to songs when you listen to an album that you would never listen to today, just high spotting, you know, the hits, right? And some of those songs that you discover when listening to an album, aka the B-sides sort of thing, may turn out to be your favorite songs by the artist that you never would have heard otherwise if you didn't listen through the entire album to start with. So it does give a deeper artist experience, I think, to listen to the full album than just to, you know, select the top hits by the artist to listen to. It's a discovery. I mean, I think it promotes discovery that you wouldn't experience otherwise.
I love that. That's a great description. Knowing this love of music that you have and the diversity of it, which music personality would you most like to chat with for an uninterrupted hour?
Living or dead?
You get your wish.
Yeah. No, you know, I think with my fascination around the development of this Seattle sound during the early 90s, you know, I think there's two artists that I would really, you know, like to sit down and talk to. One living, I think it'd be interesting to talk to Eddie Vedder, who's the lead singer of Pearl Jam, as really the sole surviving lead singer from that time period. And just get his perspectives on what went on, the development, how the scene, you know, expanded, because he had a chance to see it all, experience it all, and survive it all, which I think would just be utterly fascinating to have that sort of conversation with him, which I'm sure he gets asked those questions constantly as that sort of soul surviving, you know, big time lead singer. And the other person I would probably be, you know, one to talk to would be one of somebody that didn't survive that time period, and that's Layne Staley, who was the lead singer of Alice in Chains. I really am a big Alice in Chains fan, and really the story of the band and him and his ultimate demise due to drug addiction, I really just would like to talk to him if that was possible.
Yeah, that would be a great three-way conversation, actually.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating.
To talk to both of them at the same time and see their different perspectives on the exact same time period. And let's transition into the world of Winebow for a bit. You have a view that includes what I would consider sort of the bookends of the company. When you first worked for the company, it was the beginning of the Country Vintner. Start us there. What was that like?
Sure. I started with the Country Vintner of May of 1997. And we were single state Virginia, maybe a little bit in D.C. at that point in time, because we had just done an acquisition of Spencer Graham and Company that gave us a little D.C. presence. But we were very, very small. And we were based in the Shaco Bottom area of downtown Richmond, which at that time was pre-development of Shaco Bottom. So it was a little bit more rundown area of downtown Richmond, and, you know, really had a chance to see the very early days. I mean, it was a very small operation. We had less than 10 people in the office, and really, you know, had a much smaller environment than what we do now. But it was also sort of the foundation of the business, because that was when we started to work with a lot of the suppliers that we continue to work with in Virginia to this day. So very transformational time period. I started in, like I said, in May of 97. The following spring, the owner of the Country Vintner at the time decided to put country into the name very explicitly. And we moved out to an area outside of Richmond, rurally called Oilville. And there was a dilapidated barn out there that was to later become the offices of the Country Vintner. But in the meantime, we dropped a double wide trailer in the middle of this field behind this dilapidated barn and worked out of there. During the same time period, when we moved out there from an office perspective, we moved the warehouse out to Louisa, Virginia, into a facility out there. So we did separate the warehouse from the office, but then our offices were this double wide trailer in a old cornfield behind a dilapidated barn in the middle of nowhere. When we moved in, my desk was a door slab on top of two small filing cabinets and then a folding chair. So
super glamorous.
Yeah. It were humble beginnings to what later became a very, you know, nice facility when the barn was renovated and done, and really was the home of the Country Vintner for many years prior to its relocation to the Ashland facility where we currently are now.
How long were you a part of the organization during that period? Because I know that you left and came back. So how far into that move before you went and did other things?
I remember at this point in time, I was in my my late 20s, and I really did not I preferred to work in the city as opposed to working out in the country. So, you know, I ended up, leaving the country Vintner near the end of that year, which would have been 1998. And I went back to where I was previously, and that was with a CPA firm in Richmond. That's where I was prior to joining the country Vintner. That's my background. I have an accounting degree. I was a CPA, and I practiced, public accounting for about 4 or 5 years before joining the country Vintner, and then went back to that for about 2 years after leaving the country Vintner, and before I later went into work in the telecom field from a finance perspective, and I did that for about 7 years, and then the company I was with was bought by T-Mobile, and they relocated the operations out of Richmond, at which point in time I had the opportunity to rejoin the country Vintner further down its life cycle. And at this point, the barn was done. So I was now in the barn and not in the trailer anymore. So I did not miss any facilities, but I did rejoin the country Vintner in 2006 as the controller.
Okay. So now you're the controller at the country Vintner, and, you didn't stay as the controller at the country Vintner because somewhere in this process, you become the CFO as well. So where do we go from controller to CFO?
Right. Yeah. And, when I returned, there was already talk that there was going to be some transition in leadership. The owner was looking to retire in the next couple of years. So in 2008, the owner of the country Vintner retired, and the person who was CFO became CEO, and I became CFO at that point in time. So in 2008, I became the CFO of the country Vintner.
How would you define the role of the CEO in general?
I think the CEO role to me is sort of the equivalent of the captain of the ship, because you have the responsibility for the health and welfare of the crew, but you also got to make sure the vessel stays seaworthy. I think that's sort of the CEO's job, is to take care of the crew and take care of the vessel and make sure the ship is going in the right direction.
So the series of roles you've played in the company points to its evolution. Invest a few minutes in the overall change of scale that you've witnessed.
All right. I would guess that since I rejoined in 2006, we're about 12 times larger than we were in 2006, and that really, as I mentioned previously, was really, we were fortunate to be able to do a series of acquisitions to help sort of build this middle market solution in the fine wine sector, and then ultimately do a merger with Winebow in 2014. So we really were fortunate to be able to put together some great companies over time, whether it was Stakel Fine Wines, Quality Wine and Spirits, others as we worked through things, Henry Wine Group, but it really had a chance to really assemble a really nice group of companies into what is now Winebow today.
And now we cover the major markets with our own wholesalers, save a couple. And but that was a lot of growth, and it happened fairly quickly. I saw some of it after I joined. So where are we in that process now?
Right. If you take a step back to the very beginning, when 1997, we operated in really a single state and were very small. Now we touch the entire country, all 50 states plus the District of Columbia, as either an importer or a wholesaler. And as you said, we are a wholesaler in 7 of the top 10 markets in this country, and we cover about, and our wholesale footprint covers about 60% of wine consumption in this country. So we have a very strategic footprint that was put together intentionally to really create a wholesale network that could ultimately be supportive of our supply partners and import business as well. the real goal here is just to continue focus on fine wine artisanal spirits and work to really to continue to be that answer in the middle market space for both wine and spirits. You know, I think one thing that we've identified on the spirits front is what Winebow offered on the wine front was missing on the spirits front. There was no real middle market solution. So we've had a chance to take a spot there that was vacant and really look to continue to expand on that spot as we go forward. And not at the expense of wine, just at the opportunity with spirits.
When I was chatting with you to get ready, I think you used the word lighthouse. Is that what our team and anyone looking at us really should be seeing from us?
Right. I think we want to be a lighthouse. I think we also, you know, want to be the Rock of Gibraltar to our suppliers. I mean, I think consistency, you know, in what we do and how we run our business, confidence in us as a wholesaler partner, supplier partner, I think is critical. You know, we know the business is tough enough and out there and that things are variable day in and day out. And we want to be as consistent as possible in what we do and simplify what we do and be that simplified approach to our supply partners.
Sounds great. I'm intrigued by just the daily life of leadership, which is one of the reasons I listen to the podcasts I listen to, et cetera. And we all, as a society, just went through our version of the World War II years or our version of the Great Dust Bowl, and that was COVID-19. And so anyone that's designated as an organizational leader knows it's difficult to begin with. And then all those who led through COVID-19 had an especially difficult path. What did you gain as a leader from that difficult time?
Well, I think certainly everyone suffered and sacrificed during the pandemic. And I think whether you were in leadership or whether you weren't in leadership, it was a challenging societal situation that we're not over. I mean, we're still working through that. And I think we're going to be working through that for years to come. But as a leader, you know, I think sometimes when you're in the ordinary course of what's going on, things can get very muddled because you have a lot of things coming at you in different directions. But I think one thing that COVID period did provide was focus and clarity. I mean, one thing that you were very focused on survival in that early time period and then adjusting to the changes in the marketplace subsequently. So I do think that it helped provide some clarity and helped us even focus more intently on who we are and who we aspire to be as a company. And I think that really is how we came out of COVID as a much more focused company than we went into COVID. So I do think that's something that as a leader and as a company, we were able to achieve.
Time for our fast five questions.
Sure.
These are the short answer questions. So when you think of the future of the company, what do you want most?
To finish what we started.
Awesome. As CEO from 2018 to now, what is your favorite memory or moment?
It's probably a couple of those. I would say when we rebranded the company as Winebow in 2019, we had a rebranding launch event in New York City. Had a chance to, you know, do that with most of our New York team. And I think that was a fantastic moment to have a chance to share that experience as coming together singularly as Winebow, but also a little more selfishly from the music perspective. Our events at Easy Street Records in West Seattle have been pretty special for me, the two we've done out there.
About having been at one, I can understand why you'd say that. It was pretty fabulous. Which leader inspires you?
You know, you shot me a list of these questions so I could think about them in advance. And, you know, and I'm going to surprise you here. You know, I think there's been great leaders in history, you know, whether it's Winston Churchill, Martin Luther King Jr., but, you know, but to say that there's leaders today that particularly inspire me or guide or sort of I kind of set my compass by them would be false. You know, I'm inspired by people. I'm inspired by our teams. I'm inspired by what we accomplish here each day.
What aspect of life gets you really excited?
You know, I think, you know, the thing that I find exciting as a father is watching my children grow up and the different phases of their life. That you get to experience and live through. So I currently am have two daughters that are 22 and 20. So I'm, you know, going through some different phases of life right now with my children. And And to me, it's exciting to see them become adults right now. So I think I'm really enjoying that, actually.
Awesome. I know how that feels as well. Where are you most content?
In nature. I like to be outside. Growing up in Virginia, as I mentioned earlier, and spending really the bulk of my first 20 years here without traveling out west hardly at all, if any. As I got older, I had a chance to really visit national parks in the western part of the country and see things that, and nature elements that were just, profound and outstanding and life-changing. So I enjoy being outside. I enjoy, I enjoy the mountains. I also enjoy the beach. I find serenity in both. If I have the choice, I'm going to be outside in some real pretty place, enjoying nature.
Fabulous. Great conversation. I really appreciate your time, Dean. Thank you.
No, thank you, Ron. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks for joining me behind the scenes at Winebow Fine Wine and Spirits. Be sure to follow Winebow Insider and WineSmart, the power to buy and sell wherever you get your podcasts. Until the next episode, be kind, be successful.